Hello and welcome to The Planet Today, where we cover the latest in climate change, wildlife conservation, renewable energy, and environmental policy. It is Friday, July 26, 2024. I'm your host, Matt Norton, here by myself today because we're about to air my interview with LeVar Jackson. Before we get into things, here's a quick note from one of our sponsors. Today's episode of The Planet Today is brought to you by Valo Alta. Valo Alta's Everyday Handkerchief is a high-performance, daily-use handkerchief designed to help minimize your impact. Made in the United States from sustainably sourced Irish linen, capturing the material's historic craftsmanship and natural antimicrobial properties, handkerchiefs perfectly balance softness with durability and absorbency with rapid drying. Ideal for functional use in all settings, from the outdoors to routine encounters, their small and lightweight design makes one a must-carry for wherever life takes you. Build your own bundles from limited edition colors at valoalta.co/TPT for 15% off. That's valoalta.co/TPT. Today on TPT, we're joined by LeVar Jackson, CEO of Yogue Group, which designs sustainable technologies for the hospitality industry in partnership with Oregon State University. Yogue Group's technologies focus on efficient electricity, sustainable hotels, and an automated algae growth system for sustainable food, beverages, beauty products, and more. LeVar also serves as president of NEWH New York, which provides international resources for scholarships, education, business development, and excellence recognition in areas of hospitality, food service, senior living, and related fields. LeVar, welcome to The Planet Today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Very excited to get to talk to you and learn more about usually the thing that you're working on, but it seems like you're involved in a bunch of different things. So let's get right into it. What first got you interested in environmentalism and sustainability?
Well, it's always been... I see sustainability in my mind is additive instead of subtractive, where you can do more with what you have versus doing less and saying, telling people no. So it's something that's always been like rolling around in my brain for a very long time. I had gone to, you know, COVID hit and things had gone in a weird way. And I ended up going into the carbon credit industry, and I just really didn't like the way that was. There's a lot of fudgery and a lot of disingenuous at best sometimes, and outright fraud at others. And I thought to myself, like, I want to get back into what I was doing. I was in hospitality. I have been there for so many years. I want to come back and do something that like really resonates with me. If I want to do something, I'm going to be sustainable and I'm going to actually make that happen, where I want to be able to say, like, I can point to it directly to what I'm doing and say, this is making an impact not only on myself, but also on people's lives. And impact and sustainability are completely linked. And like you can, you know, it has to be sustainable for the people and the planet.
Yeah. And it's so interesting. I think that, and, you know, I'm going to speak in a very broad stroke here, but I feel like people in our generation, kind of care about this stuff because we have to, right? Like, we grew up in a world that was ever changing, and we're kind of in the forefront of the way things were, wasn't going to continue working. And we're now trying to right a bunch of environmental wrongs, societal wrongs. Part of that, like you said, is so linked in, you know, society and sustainability. It's more hand in hand than I think a lot of people realize.
Yes. I think we, for, you know, multiple generations had the thought of almost like infinite resources where nothing would ever go wrong and nothing would ever cease to exist. And we would find out that we are a finite people and planet, and we need to treat it as such, we need to look at our sustainability as a more systems and less point-based. Because you can trick people on points. You can't trick people on systems. You could say, oh, this is 98%. You know, efficient, but what's the 2%? What's happening with that 2%? Is it being thrown into people's backyards? Is it going to drink water? Is it becoming microplastics that are like infecting everybody? which is a fun anecdote, which I read about a couple of days ago. You know, it sounds like it's a huge task to overcome, but it's not. It's just everything that we do should have a second life. And at that after that second life, what happens to this? So if you're coming at it from a commercialization kind of standpoint, where, you know, monetary standpoint, you just don't burn up that money. If you have something left over, you do something with it. Why won't we do the same for the products and goods that we have?
Yeah, and I think something you're kind of alluding to there, that God, it's so important, is just that 2%, what is it? We talk about greenwashing on the show a lot, and a lot of companies that are like, we're so awesome, we do XYZ, and they don't tell you about everything leading up to that, you know, makes that product maybe a little better than it was, but still not nearly as good as it could be and should be for the sake of public health, ecosystem safety, and, you know, all of those things that really add up in sometimes hard to quantify ways. But it's so important to really dive into, like you said, what is that 2% doing?
Yeah, so it's, again, it's always redirect. People are very focused on point efficiency, system efficiency. What happens when this is done? What happens when all the things are finished? Where did it come from? How long it lasts? And where does it go after it leaves your hands? So I do always want to point out that climate change and sustainability is just as much as a corporate issue as it is a personal issue. And we also need to focus on that as a system. So when bad things happen, people tend to look at, you know, individual homeowners. So we'll take, for instance, you know, this beach community is now getting hit by hurricanes every year instead of every 10 or 20 years like it was, you know, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. 15, 30 years ago. We'll focus on the individual homeowners who've lost their stuff. And they're like, oh, we should absolutely focus on them, but not solely on them, because down that same beach, there's probably a beachside restaurant, and there's probably a beachside hotel that's now gone. There's, you know, maybe a fishery that's no longer in operation, and it costs businesses just as much. So it's just as much of a business, liability as is a personal one. And it seems that we are very conditioned to blame the end consumer when it's the producer who's just as culpable in that manner. So I love stories, and I love parables. So I'll focus on, imagine if you ordered, you know, pizza for delivery, right? And you're like, I want this pizza. And you call a pizza place and you get the pizza, or you go on an app, because that's what everyone does now.
Yep.
And you deliver the pizza. Now, 10 minutes later, the police show up and arrest you and say, that pizza driver killed 4 people on his way over. You're the reason that he went, and you're culpable for manslaughter because you ordered that pizza. No, you as a consumer did not ask for the driver to murder a bunch of people on his way over because he can't drive or he's high or drunk or whatever. Why is that same thing put onto the people who are buying other products? I didn't tell you to destroy the world. I didn't tell you to make this thing that's leaching chemicals into the ground. I just want my end product.
Yeah.
So in that same fact, why are we culpable as individuals for the actions of a corporation?
I think that question is something that would take so much to unpack in terms of, like, government subsidies that we've given out to big oil and big gas. And man, I wish that you and I could just, you know, riff on that for a long time. But I do also want to get more into Yoke Group and more of what you and your team are working on. So what took this whole interest in sustainability, this care for the current and the future, what then led you to becoming CEO of Yoke Group?
So I've had a couple of these ideas rolling around in my mind for energy generation and for this algae growth system. And a lot of it was by happenstance. And I like to impress on people when it comes to business or life that when you read those self-help books and you're like, I knew since I was 2 years old. No, you didn't. Nothing's a straight line in life. You're like zigzagging from left to right. It happens. So sometimes it's two steps forward and one step back in life. Don't ever, you know, chew the pill that this is the thing that someone has always done. They have sanitized their history and their past to make it look like it's a straight path when it's not.
Yeah, it's like a social media page where like you only really post the highlights.
Yes. And I had just by happenstance met an IP lawyer. And the IP lawyer I was chatting with, and I was like, I've had these couple of ideas rolling around. And he's like, this sounds like it has legs. Like, we should chat with more engineers. And it kind of rolled from there. I absolutely am a huge proponent of our education system, particularly our universities. That is the bright spot of the U.S. And we should continue to support our education in as best way as possible. It brings bright and brilliant people to the U.S. and it keeps us as a world leader in education and technologies. So I partnered with Oregon State University. I've also partnered with University of Colorado Boulder, which is different than University of Colorado. And I've gotten in trouble for saying both. So University of Colorado Boulder. To see how their takes are on what I'm doing. So I have a distinct way. And if we're getting into, we'll talk a little bit about the energy generation system. It's built on the principle of system efficiency, not point efficiency. So as long as you're using your waste or waste products, it's just as good or better than something that's highly efficient, because there is always going to be waste, because a zero waste system, even at a point, is like kind of against the laws of physics. Anyone who tells you otherwise is an absolute liar. Just a quick demonstration, because I don't want to get too technical, because I can and I nerd out a lot. So very quickly, so you take a building and you say, hey, I need heating, cooling, and electricity. All right, in the normal sense, my technology is context-based.
Okay.
It's contextual. So not one thing for sustainability is going to rule them all. The same way we got ourselves into trouble thinking oil could fix everything. It could be the plastic thing. It could be the thing you build from. It could be the thing that you put in toothpaste. That's where a lot of the microplastics came from. They were that sparkly thing in toothpaste. That's plastic.
Yeah.
So that just,
and we were just using it for years.
Yes. We just recently stopped, I think, in like 2021, but the microplastics are all in our body because of it.
Yeah.
And in face scrubs. So one tool is not going to fix our way out of it, because one tool got us into it. Don't think that one thing can work. So for instance, you'll say like, hey, I have this building and I'm going to put 100% of the roof with solar panels. What ends up happening when you're getting heat or cooling out of that, you're going to go from solar panels produce DC power versus we change it to AC. So there's conversion losses there. So even if the solar panels, quote unquote, are 100% effective, you then lose percentage in changing DC to AC. Then you lose another conversion when you change that electrical energy into to heat or cooling. So then there's another loss. So even if it's 98% effective, it's not efficient. It's not. There's still a lot of stuff. So you can say you could connect that to a heat pump. That heat pump is then 98% effective, but there's a bunch of waste, because either you're chucking out cold or you're pulling in heat. And chucking out cold into the chucking out heat into the environment, or chucking out cold into the environment, that's waste. No matter how efficient you think it is, you're just wasting things. Then there's also other problematic things. And if you just look at points, it sounds fantastic. Then, for instance, I'll take a large city like New York City, very concrete, very hot, heat island effect in the summer. What ends up happening is that when you get to about 90% saturation rate of the buildings that have heat pumps, you'll just make that heat island effect worse. You just make New York City hotter as a place. You're just dumping heat outside for the concrete to absorb, and then it's going to kick it right back inside in a never-ending loop. So you have to do things as a system. You green the streets. You put in more plants. You put in green roofs. Everything has to work together as a system, and it's the how I design everything is to work together as a system.
So let's dive into some of those designs that you're getting into now. And I'm curious about what your team has kind of brought to the table and how you take this globalized approach as opposed to just local fix, you know, one point along the sustainability journey. How do you take this more big picture, broad approach into the design phase?
So what you do is first is eliminate as many energy conversions as possible. So for that roof that was 100% solar panels, you had to do all this stuff for heat and cooling. How about you put a solar heat collector on the roof and take away some solar panels? So then you can completely eliminate the need for heating from electricity. Something simple that you can do is run a coolant loop in your basement, particularly larger buildings. Anything that's under, you know, it's deeper than 6 feet. If your basement's cool, why isn't that circulating in the summer and pulling that heat up, pulling the cool up? And that's, it's effectively not wasting anything. You're not pulling power from anything. You're not dumping heat out into the world. You can also connect, if you do have a heat pump, then take that heat pump and heat hot water with it. Instead of having that heat pump throw the heat into the, into the environment, use it. Stop wasting things. So we're always, the design phase is that we're always trying to chase the next big thing. But what if we have all the big things, we're just not putting it together?
Yeah, treat it more like a puzzle with a bunch of different pieces as opposed to the one size fits all approach that has gotten us into trouble in the past.
Yes. So that's exactly what our ethos is, particularly around our energy generation system, is like piece everything together, as few energy transfers as conversions as possible, as well as being as cheaply as possible. Like it's sustainability is for everyone, not just for the rich few. Where it's not a lifestyle brand. It is a necessity for every single person on this planet to be able to sustain themselves and the surrounding community without having to worry about, toxic waste.
Oh, yeah. I think that right now sustainability has become almost like a trendy buzzword. And that it's a twofold thing, right? Like on the one hand, that's exciting. It's great that people are caring. On the other hand, when you get like big brands doing the corporate, like, we're sustainable now because whatever it is we're doing, buy more of our products. That's still leading to a ton of overconsumption. So I do get worried sometimes when, you know, people bring up sustainability, maybe not in the environmental sphere, but when we're talking about like clothing companies talking about how sustainable their products are now. And I'm like, yeah, this is good, but you know what's even better? Thrifting.
Yes. So it goes back to life cycle, lifespan. So I'll introduce, because everyone's like, you know, stop using leather and beef and stuff like that. But if my leather sneakers have lasted me 7 years, which they have, I do have a 7-year-old pair of sneakers, is that more sustainable or less sustainable than my suede based sneakers that I burn through every 3 months or 6 months because it doesn't hold together?
Yeah.
So you have to realize, like, yeah, even if that one particular product, again, it's very much focused on point. That product me itself may be sustainable, but then it's being shipped, it's being thrown out, it's being remade every single year. Is that sustainable? No.
Yeah, it's a really good point.
It's kind of like what happened with us with recycling. We're like, oh, sure, something will happen to it later. Like, no, it doesn't. It's all being burned. Except for, I think, in like Japan and Norway are like the two top places that actually recycle things. At like 95%+ of their plastics is actually recycled. The U.S. is, we're at like 30%.
I think last thing I read, I think it was down to 9. Ooh, now.
That's bad.
Which is, yeah, it's really disheartening. And if you're listening to this and you're like, wow, these guys are really anti-recycling. Glass and aluminum, drastically different story. I think it's like 76% of aluminum that's ever been produced is still in use. Is still in use right now, which is tremendous. And glass, I mean, once it's not recyclable anymore, you can just break it down and it turns back into sand. So we have two great products.
Yeah, I actually say, like, something that we can do as, again, corporate responsibility, start standardizing packaging, particularly around glass and aluminum. Like, one weird thing, everyone's like anti-car, and I understand, like, we need to pull away from that. But one thing that the car industry has done is that all of the motor oil, like, cartons are exactly the same. They may be different colors, but they're exactly the same. They're standardized packaging. So you could just literally wash it out and put more oil in it later. So, you know, go back to the glass and milk jug days. All the glass and milks were the same and maybe have like different stencil and writing on it, but they can go back and be rewashed and, you know, cleaned and then reused again. And you can sanitize things fairly easily with not, you know, a lot of waste. Instead of having to throw that milk jug out, which may not, may not even make it to the recycling. Like, yeah, your town or municipality or wherever you live may say like, oh, this is going to recycling. It goes right in the garbage, like right into the incinerator. It gets burned. It's just fake. But that is not, I didn't ask my milk jug to be in a plastic bottle. I just want my milk. But, you know, if it came in a standard square glass jug, is no different than if it makes no material difference to me, whether it's square, circle, or triangle, you know? That's on the manufacturer, not on the individual.
Yeah. No, it's a really great point that you bring up, and I think that it's always so interesting to me. We kind of, in a lot of cases, have sacrificed a really good system for decreasing costs, and you know, the days of getting your milk delivered or even going to pick it up in the glass jugs and being able to reuse that, it makes so much sense. And we really only switched away from it because it became cheaper to produce a plastic milk carton than it did to keep reusing the glass ones.
Well, so I yes and no. So the glass ones, because we were rapidly expanding in like population around the baby boom, and that's when the plastic started coming in, because the population was rapidly expanding, so you have to make all this glass things.
Yeah.
Now the population isn't particularly expanding in many places, and it's stagnant, in fact, shrinking. Producing that glass and keeping the same number, so if there's 100, you know, 100 people, it's not like you need 200 the next, you know, year because there's 200 new people. We can go back to the longer lasting things because we're not just rapidly exploding as a population as we were before. It's an upfront investment, but then you're also like not having to do all this stuff it's a little bit of what is that phrase? Privatizing the profits while socializing the costs.
Yeah.
So, the company doesn't have to pay for that, but who pays for that, all that recycling that has to get done? The individuals do, through their taxes, through however it has to get done. So hold the businesses accountable.
Yeah. So let's also dive in a bit into the algae production that you had mentioned earlier. I'm curious, like, you know, what is your team working on with that system, and what do you see it combating in today's society that's in need of a little bit of shaping up?
Oh God, there's so much to do with this algae, and I'm going to get into it, and it's going to be a whole entire emotional breakdown for me. So I'm sorry for that. So there are three key areas I can see combating, which is food security, ethical production of goods, and plus. So we'll get into the plus. So, for instance, we're doing a project in Gambia in the fall to help provide food for school children with algae-based things. We're going to call it spirulina because everyone thinks of algae as the gross thing in a pond, and it's kind of is, but kind of not. But it's a transformative agriculture system that you can do no matter where you are. And it's arable land agnostic, I like to say. So you can take this system, grow algae to eat. Depending on the strain of algae, there are saltwater algae, so you don't need fresh water. So that's something else that we do that is in agriculture that is highly harmful. So almond milk is like, oh, it's super sustainable. It's more sustainable than milk, like cow's milk. Like, kind of yes and kind of no. The water usage on almond trees is sky high. Yeah. It's effectively like destroying California because of it. So there's up things and just down things, like upwind things and downwind things. Algae is 98% less water intensive than cotton or corn, because we'll split that there. So if you're saying like, oh, you want corn-based things or almond-based things, 98% less water intensive because it's a closed system, so you have no water evaporation. All of the water goes to either moving around the system or helping the algae grow. The algae is then strained off, and any excess water is then put back into the system. And again, you can use salt water, particularly you can use salt water instead of using fresh water. So that's not water you actually have to drink.
Gotcha.
So that's not taxing people's systems that, you know, in arid regions, I would say, or any region, I would say. The work that we've done with the automated side is that algae can be highly human intensive, particularly around scientists, because you've got to take the pH level, you've got to do testing, and you do that very frequently. So to scale up, it becomes a bottleneck around the like education level that we, you know, that you need. So we can, you know, slim that down just a little bit. So the automated system checks the pH, you know, the turbidity sensor, just how much algae is in there. We have a spectrometer that actually like looks through it and sees the type of algae and helps identify it. We have you know, salinity sensors. We have a whole bunch of sensors. So the computer does all that work, spits it out to someone who can, you know, interpret it, or in fact, we're trying to make it as simple as possible. And that then the person that's in charge, or effectively like a food scientist, can monitor large swaths of growing culture. So you're, you know, 10xing your ability to put it out per person. And because it's so sensitive and it rapidly tests the water like once every 10 seconds, it can catch bad batches very quickly and eliminate it from the system.
Gotcha.
So you get very little waste. You get high yield. It also injects nutrients when it needs to. That's also something that people won't really talk about is like fertilizer runoff.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you may be growing those almonds, but if the you know, there's fertilizer that's running off into the river, that is contaminating that river, which causes negative algae growth, which are like brown and black algae and red algae. And it's contaminating everything downriver. So people drink from it, they can't because there's fertilizer in it and you can't drink that. Any fertilizer in an algae, in our algae growth system is contained. So it's not being leased out into the environment. It's staying where it needs to stay and it's being highly effective in what it at its job. So you need less fertilizer, less things to grow that algae than if you were doing it in a plant-based system.
Gotcha. You know, when I asked the question, the only thing that I was super familiar with in terms of algae and how we could use it in our society is I've been reading stories about farmers who are mixing in algae with their cattle feed, and it reduces methane emissions, which I was like, wow, that's super interesting. I never would have thought of that. And, you know, to hear more about other applications and, you know, being able to grow this sustainably and help feed people. Yeah. I mean, that's the next logical step. I just didn't make that leap without talking to you about it.
Yeah, so you can also, so we'll get very quickly into the other uses. So you can take that, you can process it further, you can make cooking oil out of it. I have it at home, and we're not recording visually, but I have it next to me. A little oil, and it has the same properties as olive oil, but it has a higher smoke point, and I tend to make things crispier, and I kind of like that when I'm working with high heat. You can make it into textiles. You can turn that into, you know, clothing. And I have a sweater that's made from algae. It could be turned into dyes because, yeah, you can have something that's super sustainable and then you dip it in chroma, which is like the worst kind of toxic waste dye that it is. And the resulting waste is nuclear waste effectively. Like it just nukes everything that it touches and it has to go in barrels and be thrown into the ground. How about you change that? You know, like create a system that's good. Also, when it comes to the algae system, how about, I always think to myself, how do we create ethical industries?
Mm.
How do we get away from, you know, effective sometimes slave labor, slave wages? How do we create industries with our technologies instead of doing it the other way around, where the technologies then create negative industries for people? So algae, you can grow it if you don't have arable land. It could be done anywhere in the world, whether it's in, you know, the high highs north or the south, or in the middle of a, you know, a Caribbean island, you know, an island nation.
Mm-hmm.
You can grow it from grow lights. So you can grow it in wintertime and doesn't, you know, those things run at maybe 5 watts. Or you can have a loop that goes outside in the summer and, you know, in a sunny place, and that's absolutely fine. But it's still closed. It's still a closed tube. how do you, you know, like, so a lot of our, you know, particularly around clothing comes from a fact of like slave wages or slave ways, or like sweatshops or near sweatshops. How do you break that? If you don't need as many people to do it and you can do it anywhere, then you spread that out. You help pull us away from that. Because when you need a lot of people, you're going to pay a lot, you know, those few, those lot of people very poorly, versus if you don't need as many people, you can pay them quite a bit more. And you also don't need, you could do it in buildings. You could grow this algae in buildings. You can grow it. You don't need, you know, to fight for arable land that could be used for other things. You could do it anywhere. And I think that is key to us breaking the cycle of, you know, environmental violence, as well as like social sort of violence, when it comes to the way we produce things.
And I think that's a perfect segue into what I wanted to close this out today with. You know, the connection between social impact and maybe historical violence against people, against the environment, against, I mean, really, it's just different classes have been taken advantage of by the ruling class for as long as human history. What connection do you see between today's sustainability and that social impact?
If it's done right, I think it could be done fantastically. I think to myself, what am I inventing? What are the bad things that can happen from this? And I don't think we as a society do that as much. And I'll point to AI on this one. If you invent something and then within halfway through it, you go, yeah, we're probably going to need governmental intervention to keep this in the under lock and key, or to prevent something bad from happening, then why invent that in the first place? If you know it's going to be such a huge problem, or build in the safeguards as you're doing it. So being able to, so part of the way that I want to make sure that, the way that I want to make sure that it, whatever I invent doesn't get misused is making sure that people have access to it. That I want to make sure that I license this out, not just to individuals, but also to governmental agencies, to this way, again, we're doing the projects in Gambia. Like, I want to make sure that it's not just, I'm not the key holder to this. I helped make it. It came from me. But I want to make sure that everyone has access to it and reasonably priced.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like you said at the beginning, it's about access. You know, sustainability is for everybody. And in this case, if you have the opportunity to make something good, it's better if it's not behind a paywall. It's better if it's not just for the people who can afford it. So, no, I think that all sounds great.
Yeah, I will point back to, and I'm going to use cars as an example. You know, I'll point back to GM, how GM bought, you know, the, patent for hybrid cars in like the 60s and then just squashed it completely, just kept it away from everybody else. The best way for me to keep it from going to everyone, being squashed, like my company getting bought and them getting, someone getting access to it and squashing it, is to give it out to everybody now. So like, this is the time to do the licensing before someone tries to snatch my company up.
Yeah, absolutely. So, LeVar, this was awesome. I had a really great time chatting with you today, and I'm really excited for our listeners to hear this. If people want to keep up with you, if people want to keep up with your team, where is the best place, or where are the best places for them to do that?
LinkedIn is always a good place. You can find myself and Yield Group, which is, we're the only ones that have that name, so it's, we have very good SEO on that. Yog.group is a good, is our website. It's www.yog.group, yogh.group. We've got some exciting things. We're going to update our website. We've got some wild things coming. We've got some video of the algae growth system working like 100%, and it was fantastic. Cool. And you can make a lot of things out of it. We work with, I'm going to get those students in trouble. They made alcohol out of my algae. So
they are, was it good?
It was kind of like kombucha. So if it's,
okay.
I feel like kombucha is something that no one really asked for, but somehow we got it. Sorry if that happens with algae beer.
Well, we'll have to give it a shot once it's legally on the market.
Yes. I have it in my house too. So I didn't teach them. They figured it out.
I mean, that's the mark of a good student then. We end all of our interviews with three fun rapid fire questions. You ready?
Oh God, yes.
Number one, what's your favorite animal?
Oh God. Elephants.
Nice. Mine too. Number two, what is something you do to be more sustainable in your day-to-day life?
I actually live what I'm saying. So I have all the algae things in my house. Like I grow my own food in the, like a wind, my apartment window. I have make my own things at home and I try to like best have fun and be the example of what I want to be.
Awesome. Last one. What is one topic you think my listeners should be more aware of after hearing from you today?
Oh God, corporate liability when it comes to sustainability. Hold them accountable.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's something that we're going to have to just keep repeating until people get it. But no, that's perfect. Cool. Thank you so much. Like, again, I really appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you.
All right. That is it for today's episode of TPT. Thank you again to LeVar for his time. This was awesome. Really had a good time on this interview and hope you had a good time listening. We're going to be back next Friday for another episode, but until then, go check out our socials at Planet Today Pod for more TPT in the meantime. And make sure you swipe up, click those links in your show notes to get more from Yoga Group, from LeVar, from NEWH New York, and obviously anything else that we linked in there. For the Planet Today, I am Matt Norden. See you next Friday.